It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Welcome. Our topic today is Chugach State Park. It's an amazing resource. It's that whole backdrop to our city. The one thing that really makes our city beautiful is definitely not the buildings, it's the mountains. And we're really fortunate that all that land has been protected and is available for us for recreation and for wildlife use habitat and for whatever we decide to make of it. If you've been around the country to a lot of the national parks, as I have done as a writer, you realize that what we've got right here at home is really unique and really second to none. And it's, you know, half an hour from the middle of town. But as the city grows, usage of the park has gone up dramatically, and its nature has really started to change, especially on the edges. Surely in the middle, it's still pretty wild and pretty unused. But when you go up to there, to the Glen Alps area in particular, you find a lot of people all seasons of the year. And so our topic today is Chugach State Park and how we want to use it, how we want to see it developed or preserved. And I've got two guests in the studio today. Tom Harrison is the superintendent of Chugach State Park. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Great to be here, Charles.
And Helen Nienhauser is a conservation pioneer in Anchorage, if you don't mind giving that name, and an author. She wrote 55 Ways to the Wilderness in South Central Alaska, which is now in its fifth edition, which is sort of the original trail guide to getting around our area. And you've been all over the park and all over the trails since the beginning, I imagine.
Yes.
Yes. Thanks for being with us. So, Tom, we see that there are traffic problems and parking problems at Glen Alps. There are certainly a lot of people out there using the park at these trailheads. Do you have records or a sense of park usage and how it's changed over recent years?
Well, the good weather calls out a lot of people into the park, and there are a number of places throughout the park, and not only Glen Alps, where the demand for access really exceeds the capacity. And I think over the years, as the population is, you know, pushed further and further out, it's butted up against the park boundary, and so it's created a lot of challenges in a lot of ways, and that is such a heavily visited area because it offers access for multiple uses for lots of different types of users. And so that's one that hangs out there pretty mm-hmm. good.
Well, Helen, you have been using the park for decades, back from before it was really a park, right?
Yes.
And I'm just curious as to when you look at what it was like back then mm-hmm. and what it's like now, what kind of changes you see, you know, for the worse or for the better?
Well, the big thing is that it's a protected park. I mean, when I started here in 1959, you'd look at those mountains and you didn't know how to get there. And that was really part of the impetus for writing this book. There was a predecessor, 30 Hikes in Alaska, that was done by the Mountaineering Club of Alaska, and I participated in that. And then it seemed that our publisher was interested in something more like their series in the Pacific Northwest. And so we embarked on this to tell people how to get there. And that was usually the homestead roads, many of which are now trails.
Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an adventure to go out there. And I imagine you wouldn't see many other people. Now when you go, it's much more developed and you see a lot more people. Is it in any way diminished? Or what are the sort of changes for you when you go out?
Well, I think it's getting to the point where the edges are being diminished. There are all these things we call social trails, and that's, of course, all we had originally. But now, I have not seen Blueberry Knoll recently, but now I understand that there are just dozens of social trails going off the maintained trail.
It's just trampling. Yeah.
And it's being trampled, and I've seen that in lots of different places. I think people just don't understand and need some education.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of users of this park, and there are others who probably would like to be using it, but because of whatever regulation exists, they may not be able to use it for the purpose that they have in mind. And I'm thinking of All the different trail users we have in Anchorage, we have our skiers and our snow machiners and our ATV riders and our horseback riders and our mountain bike riders. And I guess they'd all like to be up there in one form or another. And so there are a lot of issues involving the park, a lot of lovers of the park. And I'd like to get you on the air as we continue our discussion about Chugach State Park and how you would like to see developed or not developed the access to the park and the way we use it. So the way you get on the show is you call 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're calling from outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. Email, we'll read them on the air, is hometown@alaskapublic.org. That's a good way to get your comment in because you don't have to sit on hold. And we also have a website at alaskapublic.org. And if you go there, you'll find links to some of what we're talking about. There's a link to the Chugach State Park, information about the park master plan process, an article about the Glen Alps parking project, and you can even look at Glen Alps through the webcam, which is linked to our page. Tom, tell us about this parking project. I know that there's been a parking problem at Glen Alps for a long time. Is this going to solve it? Is it enough parking to take care of the problem?
Basically, it's a satellite parking. If you look at the space that's up there right now, it's about 155 slots. I haven't individually counted them, but that's about the number that's up there right now. And what this is it's a satellite. You go moving towards the power line down the lower access trail. And it'll add about 50 new slots. Now, you could probably do a Google Earth or something and see photographs where there's more cars than 50 that are parked outside on the road. So it definitely isn't going to accommodate those the maximum days. However, it should accommodate more and make it a little bit less. We've also improved the parking down at Upper Huffman parking area, which it's probably the closest. It's really the closest parking access in the park, too, to hope to help alleviate that. And a lot of people aren't aware of that. It's a good winter access. It's also a good summer access, and then it gives bike access down up the Silver Fern Trail to get into the gas line and power line. But it also has some beautiful views from there, too. And hopefully right now we've kind of took away the $5 fee for that parking while the construction is going on because there's going to be some additional congestion. But hopefully it's not going to solve the problem, but it'll help mitigate it.
And for folks who we're going to be talking about a lot of places and trail names, there'll be some folks who don't know what we're talking about, but they can find maps and information about all those trails on your website.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's at alaskapublic.org. No problem. So the webcam that's focused on the parking lot is essentially like a rationing mechanism, right? So you can look at it and see that there's no room, and you don't want people parking on the road. If they can't park in the lot, you don't want them to come. Is that correct?
Well, we encourage carpooling. There's a shuttle service from downtown that's available that can get people up there. But what we thought is, you know, now in the day of all the those multimedia phones and whatnot, if people can just look it up real quick right before they head up, it might say, well, maybe let's go try. There's a lot of wonderful places in the park that they might think of as alternatives.
Well, on this, I'm looking at the webcam, and on this rainy Wednesday afternoon, there's plenty of room in the parking lot. So, yeah,
exactly.
But on a sunny weekend, you probably need to be up there by like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning to get a parking space. Helen, what do you think about this? I mean, is there going to be enough room to just keep building parking, or do we need to look at some other options?
Well, I think we need to look at some other options. I think Glen Alps is going to continue to be the premier destination. But there are, as Tom says, lots of other wonderful places in the park, and not all of them have access. And we need to have more smaller lots scattered around the perimeter so that people from all parts of the bowl and from the Matsu Valley can easily get to the park without having to drive all the way to Glen Alps.
And any particular spots where that you think we should be doing that?
All over, but right. I have some favorites. You know, one of my favorites is the Stewart Homestead, which is up at the head of Potter Valley, but you get to it from Rabbit Creek and Golden View Drive, and the head of Potter Creek Valley is not yet developed. It's going to be if we don't do something quickly. And the Stewarts left that property to the Botanical Gardens and I think the zoo. And my understanding is that they're willing to sell. Now, I know there's still going to be an access problem. I don't understand the details of that. But that provides access to McHugh Peak. I walked up there through Stewart's Homestead when my son, my co-author now, was about six with a buddy of his, and we climbed McHugh Peak. It is way easier than Flat Top. And marvelous views, and it would be a crime to not get hold of that while it's available and before the surrounding lands get developed. So that's one of my real favorites. Mm-hmm. I got a list. I can go on.
Let me turn to Tom. What's the possibility of doing some of that, of building some new or getting some new access?
Right. We've been pretty heavily involved in a pretty substantial planning process for, at least the last 3 years or so. And one of the components is addressing what Helen is talking about, and that's access. And it's preserving it for the future and identifying it up front. And so this is a plan that we're looking to adopt jointly with the municipality because, you know, it's the municipality is up against the park, and it takes both to try to have a rational, logical approach to addressing these issues. And what Helen brings up is really true is that area over the McHugh complex, really there isn't any easy access that doesn't have to go through private property, which they're non-secured access points at this time. And so that's kind of the planning process, is to look at the park as a whole. One thing I just mentioned real quickly, I look at the boundary of the park is like a membrane, like a living organism's membrane, and there has to be active transport to get, you know, people in and out. And like Helen said, you know, you can either have some heavily focused areas that apply a lot of pinpoint pressure, or you can diffuse that over a broader area. You know, there's some nuances to all that, but essentially that's what it really gets down to, is identifying where those are, and that's the whole impetus of the access plan. Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like you've got an issue of coordination there, but also potentially an issue of money and buying private parcels to make it happen. Do you have the money you need to do that kind of work? I know we all put our $5 in, and that's got to add up. So what happens to the $5, and is that available for you to go out and buy private property so you have better access?
A lot of times it really isn't. I mean, the park is 500,000 acres. We have quite a bit of property, and you know, some of it's more suitable for that type of development than other. The park was created by the legislature. And so it's a legislatively designated boundary. And so a lot of the property things were, you know, three or four times a year somebody comes up, I've got this great piece of property to buy. Well, hillside property is not inexpensive. Development costs are fairly expensive. And so those are all things that kind of have to be weighed. But part of the issue is that if it's land that's outside of the park boundary, then it's going to take legislation to incorporate it.
I guess I was thinking that access to me means, you know, you can drive there. There's a public right of way, and then you can get out of your car and walk into the park. Is there a lack of that kind of access where you do need to acquire property, or do you feel like it's more of an issue of just developing the access?
It's both, and it's varied. In some of the circumstances, it maybe nothing seems simple, but like, easement. There are a lot of right-of-ways issues, but there's a lot of areas that there aren't. It's private property, and there isn't what we call secured access, in that there isn't legal access. And that's why the joint plan is really important. So when it gets to the municipalities, the zoning and platting and whatnot, that those access, public accesses, aren't closed off.
Mm-hmm. Helen?
Yeah, well, and topographically, for instance, I think that what was the Stewart Homestead there's some level land there that could be used as parking. Now, I don't know exactly where the boundary goes, but I strongly suspect that there isn't topographically a place for parking unless we buy this parcel that is outside the park. And I think there's a number of cases like that where it does mean acquiring a piece of property outside the park, at the edge of the park, in order to be able to provide parking. And I know people are very worried about repeating Glen Alps in their neighborhood, and I think we should avoid doing that. But if we can create smaller, a number of smaller access points, maybe we won't have to do
right.
that.
Well, I'm old enough to remember that the Glen Alps was there long before there was a neighborhood, right? There was not even any road up, or there was a sort of a trail up there. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're talking about Chugach State Park. I have two guests in the studio, Tom Harrison, who is the superintendent of the park, and Helen Nienhauser, who's been a park user since, I guess, 1959, did you say?
No, 1970, when the park was created.
Well, of the land that is the park.
Yes.
Since much earlier, and is author of 55 Ways to the Wilderness, which is an excellent trail guide. And if you would like to get on the air with us, the phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Helen, do you have any concerns about the way that trails are being improved and developed? I was hiking the South Fork Eagle River Trail this summer, and the portion that goes, there's sort of a new, very nice parking lot there, and then the portion of the trail that goes to the bridge has been fixed up to a pretty high standard, which is not the kind of standard that you think of as being Chugach State Park. It's really pretty fancy with borders and gravel and the whole thing. And it's a change in terms of the aesthetics and the feel of the park. Does that concern you at all?
Well, there is this issue of that the park is within, I believe I've been told, 30 minutes of 53% of the state's population. If you count Anchorage Bowl and Matsu Valley, and parts of this park are on the edge of Matsu Valley, we've got to do something. So I haven't seen, in order to accommodate that use, at the same time, we don't have to accommodate all uses that would like to be there all of the time. It's a fine balancing act, and there are limits. But we're a long ways from reaching the limits in the park as a whole, and at this point, we need to diversify the use. So I haven't been on the South. I was on the South Fork Trail as the construction was beginning, and I was pretty unhappy with it. I haven't seen it now, and having
unhappy because you thought it was just too much.
Yeah, it's big and wide, and I was afraid it was being set up for mountain bikes, which is another issue. I mean, I'm a mountain biker as well, but not an extreme mountain biker. And I didn't want to see all the level trails, in relatively level trails in the park, becoming bicycle trails. Apparently, that was not the intention with this, and I don't know why it was so big. So we lose a little bit of the original character.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to have some trails like that in some places. I'm not sure that's the right place to start.
Tom, is that a consideration of, like, keep it natural as opposed to improve it so it can handle more people? Is that a balance you have to reach?
It is a balance, and we certainly do like the feedback because that's public lands, and there's a demand for lots of different types of use. And that particular trail happens to offer a great entry level to encourage youth and people. A lot of school groups go out there,
It's pretty easy.
Right, and it's a great ski trail, actually, in the winter, too, now with the less steep grades. I guess one consideration is that although that does change the initial character in some respects, it does lead you to some great routes back there up Hanging Valley or out beyond, you know, Eagle and Symphony Lake, and to get the more rugged adventure experience that a lot of people are really looking for.
Right. So we're moving it. It's moving back a little bit because there's more people in the foreground. And really, when you go up to Glen Alps these days, there's so darn many people out there using it that it's not really very much a wilderness experience unless you do hike a ways. Agreed?
Yeah. And if I could just add one thing, I remember being very upset at the Forest Service with some of the things they did years ago on trail development in the Chugach National Forest. And we even had a picture of new construction where it was a ditch. You know, you wait a few years and the vegetation grows back in and you have a lovely trail.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very careful balancing act, but I am a little more careful now to criticize in the first year after a trail has been developed.
I'd like to go now to a caller. William is on the line from Anchorage. William?
Hey, how's it going? I just was, you know, listening to all this stuff, and I'm a very frequent park user. You know, I probably a couple days a week at least get up there. And in the last couple of years, just to take it back to the Glen Alp trailhead and stuff, I've pretty much avoided completely that trailhead because of the craziness of the parking and the amount of use that those trails see. However, in my experience, limited as it might be, I mean, I've been up there for a couple decades now, running around in the mountains. The vast majority of people are focused on Flat Top, and they just go up and down Flat Top. If you head back even a little bit onto the power line, that you hardly see people, let alone, you know, hike up Wolverine or O'Malley or any one of those number of peaks that are accessible from the Glen Alps trailhead. So I'm just wondering if maybe the Flat Top Glen Alps could kind of be a sacrificial lamb for some of the other trail users that, you know, like myself, that we just don't use that. And I almost like the fact that I know that I can go to almost any of the other entrances to the park, whether they're official trailheads or one of my favorites is up off Canyon Road to get to the backside of Flat Top or Rabbit Lakes. And oftentimes, even on a nice day, it's relatively easy to find parking. You might see a half a dozen people out there hiking around, and I often run up the backside of Flat Top and won't see a soul until you get to the top, and there'll be 30 people up there wandering, milling about, wondering how they're going to get back down that other trail.
I think it's a good point. You know, I wrote a book about the national parks, and I hate crowds on a trail, but one of the things I discovered is that in most of the national parks, well over 90% of the people never go a mile from the road. So you walk a mile and you're in a real national park. You stay near the road and you're not. And in a way, I guess because of its popularity and people knowing about it, Flat Top has become one of those national park-like overrun areas. I don't know. What do you think when you hear that sacrificial lamb terminology, Tom? I mean, that's, you don't want to sacrifice anything. On the other hand, I guess that's where people want to go.
Right. I guess I'd try to put it in a different context in that, you know, a lot of people that come to Anchorage, you know, you have family coming to town or something, you want to take for a nice quick overlook up there with elder parents or whatnot. It's a beautiful place to go. And I mean, my goal is to make it a place to be proud of for the city and to do it with, you know, with a bit of class you know, take away some of that that feel. There are going to be those places that can accommodate or that accommodate a lot of use. It's just not the Overlook. A lot of people do go to Flat Top, but a lot of people also do go and access, you know, the power line for biking or for skiing and some of those other things. So,
William, we were, before you came on, we were talking about spreading out the usage and building more trailheads. Are you kind of giving the opposite point of view? Keep the usage concentrated, then the people who are sort of in the know can spread out their usage?
Well, I think that, again, just kind of knowing how people function, you can spread out the usage and put a bunch of lovely trailheads all up and down the park boundary like that for us, but it seems like a lot of the people that would normally kind of get off the beaten path, if you will, anyway, those are going to be the same people going to those, and there's still going to be a huge concentration of kind of the non-avid hikers or what have you that are going to go to Flat Top because that's where you go. I mean, that, you know, I've lived here my whole life, and that's just where everyone ends up going up to Glen Alps and doing that. And like I said, at this point in my life, I literally never go to that parking lot because I know that if it's a day that I want to be up in the mountains, if I'm not toughing it out in the rain or something, there won't really be any parking there. And I can access many of the peaks and places that I like to go from lots of other places. You just have a little bit more of an uphill hike, and Glen Alps is the highest spot. So that's kind of why people go there, is that you get as high as possible without much physical effort. You know, you can climb up Blueberry Hill and be much higher than you could with, you know, a decent amount of hiking from any one of those other trailheads.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a really good point. And we're going to take, I thank you for calling. We're going to take another caller, Sylvia, calling from Anchorage. Sylvia?
I had a couple of comments. The first one is I really hope that we can keep most of the Chugach as a true wilderness area, and that people see and realize the value of that before it's too late. There are so many places now, including like in Kincaid Park, they have the fast track biking trails now. And I love biking and skiing and everything, but with that, it's the speedway, you know, with bicycles, and that there was someone I heard complaining that there was a moose there that had a baby, and they were complaining about it. There were several that they couldn't go as fast as they wanted. It wasn't so I really would hate to see Chugach turn into something along those lines. They're just places that we need to keep for wilderness, and they are quickly disappearing. Also, the other comment I had was I heard about the Stewarts donating the land, which I'm sure their intent would have been to keep, you know, the beautiful area. And now that they're talking about selling off those areas, and surprised me that there could not have been something put in that donation saying it would have to be used for its original intent. In Texas, where I came from, there was a property like that, and they said if it wasn't used for the original intent, it would go back to the heirs. So that's just a little comment.
Right, and I don't know if we have that information. Helen, do you know?
No, I don't know.
Can you respond to her first comment about, well, I guess it's about the incompatibility of different kinds of uses. There's hiking is maybe the least impactful use, mm-hmm. and then there's biking, and then there's motorized use. Do you think there's room for those uses other than hiking, or how do you see those different uses interacting in the park?
Well, I am a firm believer that multi-use trails only work at a very low level of use. Mm-hmm. And in Chugach State Park, we'd have to look at it case by case, but I think that we are way beyond low level of use, certainly anything you can access from Glen Alps. So, and it depends on the use. I think snow machines and skiing on the same trail are, or in the same area, are not compatible.
Not even safe.
And not even safe. But I think mountain bikes and hikers on the same trail, depending on the trail, I think it works on Powerline because it's wide and it's pretty straight and you've got good sight distance.
Right. Well, but that's a difference between, you know, that and what, you know, you'll see in, like, in Kincaid, you know, the curves and that sort of thing.
It's a good comment, Sylvia. Thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Tom, how do you keep those uses segregated, especially when we're talking about, seasonally, obviously, the snow machines and the skiers are pretty much segregated. Yes?
Well, just to get back a little bit, on the park is managed for the intent of the legislation when it was passed, and it has five primary purposes of the park, and it's one is to protect and supply water. A lot of people don't know that, but a lot of the water for Anchorage. It's to provide recreational opportunities, of which there are many, and there's differencing of opinion about, you know, what's appropriate or what is not appropriate. Protect scenic value, provide areas for local display of wildlife, and one of the primary purposes is to protect the wilderness characteristics, but it specifically identifies the eastern portion of the park. And so that's how we... From a land manager's perspective, we do it. We do try to deconflict users. You know, there's the dog machine is another piece to the thing. And then there's, you know, horses, you know, versus not horses in some areas for or you know, dogs or no dogs. Or there's a lot of nuances to that.
Yeah. Let's get into that more in the second half hour of the show. Right now we're going to be taking a break. And when I come back, I'll give those phone numbers again. We have several callers lined up, but we're going to try to get to all of them and continue our discussion here on Hometown Alaska. Stay with us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is Chugach State Park and the changes that the park is going through because there are so many people who love it. And we don't want it to be loved to death, but we also want to be able to use it and have access to it. And we want to use it in a lot of different ways. And so it's a complicated job. And so to talk about that, I've got in the studio Tom Harrison, who is the superintendent of Chugach State Park, and Helen Nienhauser, who is been there since before it was a park as a user and is author of the well-known book 55 Ways to the Wilderness in South Central Alaska. You can find a bunch of information about our discussion and a link to Helen's book and to the Chugach State Park website and some other resources on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on Chugach State Park People Pressure. That's the heading. And you can call in and participate in the show by dialing 550-8433. So that's a local call, 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. And the email address here is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we welcome you to get involved in the conversation. We were talking a little bit about different uses of trails, and we have a couple of calls I wanted to get to, but I just wanted to quickly just clarify one thing with you, Tom. Are there areas of the park that are segregated so you can do this use or not that use? And how do people find out about that?
Sure. A lot of that information is actually on the back of the IMUS map that most people are familiar with. But yes, there are areas that are open to, you know, horses or closed to horses or open to bicycles or closed to bicycles or open to motorized or not open to motorized.
And so those would be posted at the trailhead as well, I assume?
Correct.
Okay. So if you want to get out in the wilderness and not worry about bikes or not worry about other or horses or whatever, you can find that information. Well,
correct. And also with respect to hunting and trapping or other issues that are in people's minds.
Boy, there are a lot of hot issues we can talk about on this subject. I'd like to go now to a caller who contacted me earlier about an event that's happening about conservation here in Anchorage. Danielle?
Yes, thank you, Charles. I appreciate you inviting me to call in today to tell people about our Conservation Achievement Awards program. I work for Alaska Conservation Foundation, which is the only public foundation dedicated to conservation in Alaska. And for more than 25 years, we have recognized through our annual awards program the remarkable achievements of dedicated individuals working to preserve Alaska's wildlands, waters, and wildlife, which, as we know, sustain the ways of life that are, you know, meaningful to Alaskans. And this is a really wonderful tie-in to today's program about the Chugach State Park, because it's not by accident that the park was, you know, that we all cherish was created. It took a group of dedicated citizens to advocate for it. And these are exactly the types of lasting contributions we honor with our Achievement Awards program. So tomorrow night, in a ceremony to be held at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, we'll be presenting awards to an inspiring group of 10 Alaskans from all over the state. And it's really a truly an exceptional group of people because they work tirelessly every day to protect what makes Alaska so special to us all. And I was wondering, do I have time to highlight a few of them for you?
Well, let's just do maybe the top two.
Okay, that's great. So we'll be celebrating the contributions of Alaskans like Wally and Jerry Cole. Wally and Jerry are longtime business owners of Camp Denali and Denali National Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing wilderness lodge right near Wonder Lake. I'm not sure if you've been there.
Yep.
The Coles have been tireless advocates for building an economy based on a healthy environment, and we're looking forward to celebrating their accomplishments tomorrow, as well as what makes this an extra special year is that we'll be presenting a Lifetime Achievement Award for the first time in a number of years to Jack Lentfer, who is a highly respected, do you know Jack?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, Jack is a highly respected scientist who dedicated his career to polar bear research, which has contributed greatly to their preservation around the world.
That's great. Well deserved. And so where do people find, where is the event taking place?
The event's taking place at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. And, I invite your listeners to learn more about the recipients and how to nominate someone in the future by going to our website at www.alaskaconservation.org.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
And now I'd like to go to Peter, who's calling from Eagle River and I think has a question about trails. Peter?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Tom. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
I have a question for Tom, and that is, could you pull off the top of your head how much State Park spent to survey the South Fork of Eagle River Trail for its rehabilitation, and then a total cost of what was spent so far for the crews to put the trail in? And while you're thinking of that, I just want to say I was on the trail last Sunday. It's fantastic. It's a nice corridor to get into the backcountry, and I realize it's a scar right now, but in a couple of years, it'll grow in, as Helen mentioned. So thank you. And could you give me that number, Tom?
Well, I think that the actual survey, when all was said and done, and there was a little bit more surveying in some of the other areas to lay that sustainable trail out, was probably in the order of $5,000 to $6,000. I'm trying to remember what the costs were originally. There was a contract let for the original work last year that was probably, and then with the trail crews over the last couple of years, you're looking at probably close to $220,000, I'd say, between them. And there's a lot of reasons, and it always sounds more than it is, but there are some reasons
like
for that.
Sounds like more than it should. Yeah. It looks like it'll last a long time, though.
But does that also include the trail improvements? It probably doesn't. That was just for the trail that you gave me. State Parks also improved the trail at that location.
Yeah, no, that the 220 is the trail. It's that, I mean, to have the two individuals to go out and lay the sustainable trail was around $5,000-$6,000. But that also included looking at some alternatives for getting up to the saddle there to drop down into Arctic Valley. And it also included some of the work that was done on the other side of the South Fork as a potential route.
All right. Good enough, Peter?
Well, thank you, Tom. I have one more thing to add in there. I really appreciate the efforts that State Parks has taken to improve the trails in Chugach State Park, because I classify myself as a super user. I, as other callers have mentioned, use the park several times a week. I love it as a resource close to Anchorage, and we're very fortunate to have it. And thank you for what you do, Tom. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Peter. We got a bunch of calls and emails, so I'm going to sort of run through them here. Ken emails. He says, within the Chugach State Park, there are numerous abandoned, rusted, and crumbling communication structures. On the ridgeline above Eagle River, there are several that have been abandoned for at least 35 years I've lived here. Is there any effort to require the responsible parties to remove these blemishes?
We'd probably have to go down specifically, because a lot of times what people think are in the park are not in the park. And there are structures, though, and facilities, and sometimes they're old state facilities that predate the formation of the park. So we'd really have to kind of go down specifically, but you bet. We'd like taking things out. As a matter of fact, working with Chugach Electric, we're taking out some of the distribution line that went between Potter Valley and McHugh, or past McHugh to Rainbow.
Okay. Now I want to turn to Mary. She's been waiting a long time. Mary, did you have a question? Hello, Mary. All right. Well, I think Mary gave up. So let's go to Till, who is on the line and says she's a pre-park resident. Did you have a question?
Yeah, hi. Well, I don't have a question. Maybe a comment. We homesteaded in 1960, and then out at Eagle River area, Chugiak specifically, and then the park got around us in 1970. We were in Holders, but we were there first. But anyway, this thing at Glen Alps, it's obviously not the only place to get a good view, and it almost sounds foolish to me. I've been here 57 years to hear about the overcrowding in the parking lot, and it's kind of like having a skyscraper and having all the people fit in one little room. I mean, when the building representing the park, when there's so many other places for access, and for some reason, and there's access to property already directly to the park. The one comment, somebody said you got to buy outside land, I mean, you could level off all the mountains if you wanted and pave it, and then nobody would have a problem. But as far as having motorized vehicles, I'm not against them at certain places in the park, but the sound is certainly not compatible with quiet. But anyway, I'm all for the park, and I certainly feel it ought to be open to handicapped people, to all kinds of people, but in proper places at proper times, and not everybody on the same trail trying to do the different things.
Yeah.
I'll shut up, but it's an interesting program.
Well, thanks much. Thanks for your call. I want to turn to Helen, and I guess my question as a writer who's looked at the park for a long time, do you think that the popularity of Glen Alps is just because that's the spot that everybody knows about?
That's part of it, for sure. The things that are not in my book are things that don't get a whole lot of use. You know, that's a mixed blessing, too. But, anyway, I do think better information about all of these little places, and I don't know. Getting information out, however, is a tricky issue also, because if Tom was to publish all of the little trailheads that are designed for 3 cars or 6 cars, that would then quickly be overrun, because they really are designed more for people who live in that general area to be able to get there.
The other thing at Glen Alps is that you... sort of the typical American attitude is you can drive there and you're above tree line with an amazing view. And I don't know if there's another trailhead that really has that quality of you know, effortless sort of alpine terrain.
Well, the closest option to doing that is in Arctic Valley and Site Summit. Mm-hmm. That, of course, I mean, and there is a lot of potential there that is not going to disturb any neighborhood. However, it demands the cooperation of the military and to fully develop. I mean, there's things we can do without the military, but, you know, that ridge that you get to from the pass on the way to Rendezvous, if you could do a loop over to Site Summit and down. I don't know the current status of any of that, and Tom could probably fill us in, but...
And the views are just as good as Glen Alps on the way up to Arctic Valley, in my opinion.
I mean, right, that is a military road that you have to access through.
I got you. Yeah. All right, I'd like to go to Bob now, who's calling back to trail development. Bob?
Yeah, hi. I live in Eagle River. I've been here about 36 years, and the reason I've hung on is because of Chugach State Park. I'd like to address your question about whether or not to spread out usage. I guess my personal preference by far would be to focus usage in a relatively few areas and do not spread it out, because what happens when you spread it out, when you increase the size of the parking lots, when you improve the trails like up South Fork and even up Eagle River Valley per se. It's not just allowing access for the people that previously wanted to get there and didn't find a place to park. It encourages more use. With more parking and better trails and less effort, it doesn't solve the problem at all. It just magnifies it and spreads it just like a four-lane highway does over a two-lane or a dirt road.
Tom, do you want to take that one?
Well, I mean, we're you know, you always try to get ahead of the curve, and the reality is that it's public land, and we like to encourage people to get outdoors. And I understand there's a balance, and I'm not trying to shun that, but to do it in a logical, rational fashion is kind of our roles and responsibilities, and that's what we're attempting to do by this planning process, to make it more transparent to the public so they can look at the documents and see where the development suggestions are and get their input through credible discourse, so that we do move forward in a measured way, but in a measured, rational way, that so from 20 years from now, I know Helen mentioned the social trails, if we don't do something, then people are scrambling across private property, taking machines where they shouldn't be taking them, and then it becomes more chaotic, I guess. And it increases the damage to the natural resources with which we are to protect and preserve.
Well, I've got to jump back in there then, because if you're more concerned about trespassing on private property and working around the edges, I guess that's to me where the focus of you should be. But as far as getting ahead of the curve is concerned, that strikes me as the same mistake the Park Service made several decades ago and has stepped back from that. And again, you suck more and more people in deeper and deeper the more you improve things. And the fact is, and I can say this absolutely, is that if you wanted to go there, you could get there. You don't have to lead the people and make everything 100% convenient for them. For instance, up South Fork, the worst place up there is about halfway up, and you get into a lot of boggy country, and it's wet and mucky and terrible. Okay? Well, you better believe that stops a lot of people from going up there more than once. Okay? And while I understand protection of the resource, even if you had an area 50 feet wide, which is absurd, it's just, you know, tramped into the muck, in the overall scheme of things, that's really just a little pinprick compared to what you're doing by inviting a lot of people up to Symphony and Eagle Lakes, where there's no place to camp anyhow, really, other than a very few isolated spots.
Okay, Bob, you know what? You've made a really good point, and you've made it well, and we're going to move on. But I think that there's a good number of people who agree with the concept that one way of rationing, one way of keeping it wild, is just making it harder, right? And that's a decision that we have to make as a community, as a state. So thanks for being with us. The show is Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Woolforth. Tom Harrison is with me. He's the superintendent of Chugach State Park. And Helen Nienhauser is an author and longtime park user. And we've just got about 10 minutes left to get through a few more phone calls and emails. I don't know if we'll get through them all, but we're going to give it a shot. Next, I've got Jim, who had a question about lichen. Jim?
Yes, hi, thanks. I've been in the park a few times, and I noticed there's vast expanses of knee-high lichen that is, according to a field guide I looked at, it's a reindeer moss. It ought to be suitable for caribou. Why aren't there caribou up there? Seems like good habitat, maybe.
We've had silence has fallen in the studio. So.
I would defer to fish and game representatives.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know that there's any caribou in this far south in south central Alaska. There must be some habitat reason for that, but I think you have to go up to like Neltina area.
There are caribou on the Kenai,
but I
don't know anything about caribou in the last 50 plus years in the Chugach.
All right. Well, you stumped us, so we're going to move on. Here's an email. This person asks, gated communities have been systematically closing off some of the best hiking access points. Why can't there be some type of easement through these private roads if Chugach State Park owns the boundary to the park? Is that something that you look at when land is platted and when private roads are put in to see if we can get access to those areas?
Right, and that's that joint access plan that I mentioned before is an attempt to address that issue. Once you get outside of the state land, then of course we'd like to work with the municipality and with the developers and things for that access, but jurisdictionally it gets difficult.
Helen?
And I'd just like to add that I learned that access plan is before planning and zoning on Monday night.
Oh, really?
And so people who are interested in access ought to come support it.
Yeah, go to muni.org to find out what's happening at the Planning and Zoning Commission to talk about that plan. Another email. Why is there a dog musher giving rides commercial user on the power line? Is this legal? Tom?
Yes, it is. It is legal. There's a permitting process for a number of different types of things, and one of them is for commercial use, just like there is for ATV rides, like there is for the concession contracts, and things of that nature. But it is. However, we understand that it does cause some user conflict, and so we like to get feedback. So if this individual has some input, we're more than willing to listen.
All right. I'll forward that email to you after the show. Leads me to another winter question, which is when we have a bad snow year, as we seem to have more and more frequently, skiers who want to ski on groomed trails, you know, with performance skis can't ski because Kincaid, you know, service don't have any snow. More and more people are going up to Glen Alps. Last winter, early in the season, my gosh, there were huge numbers of people skiing back and forth on the Powerline Trail. Is there, at times I've heard discussion about grooming and taking equipment up there. Is that something that the park is receptive to? Does that happen, or is it something we avoid?
We do grooming, but we also respect that there are a number of individuals that prefer no grooming. And so what happens is when there isn't a lot of snow down low, we work with the Nordic Ski, and we might let them bring up their piston bully and do something on the power line. But if there is a substantial amount of snow down low, then we will keep that out. Now, we do some small grooming within our own resources. Mm-hmm. So it varies.
Right. And you're not trying to get it up to the competition level that they have at Kincaid, but just to...
Correct, because we are multi-use trails.
Right. And Mary has a comment about public transportation at Glen Alps. Mary?
Well, I wondered why there couldn't be a municipal bus that went up maybe three times, especially in the... Saturday and Sundays, because the youngsters are out of school. We want them out and about, and they would enjoy being able to get up there. And if there were public transportation, you know, maybe three, maybe four times a day that people were aware of, I think that would be an extremely good thing to have.
Is that a possibility? I suppose that would be up to the city as to whether they wanted to send a bus up there.
Well, the state seems to be working with the city municipality, mm-hmm. and
no,
unions or what?
No, I think that would come down to the economics. If it was cost effective, we certainly
something like that cost effective. I mean, there is another access to Glen Alps. That the snowmobilers use, I know. I don't know about skiers or hikers, but it's down a bit lower where you do not have to make that U-turn and do the scenic route to get up there. Years and years and years ago, they used to close it because there was private property that we had to cross, and we were able to buy that person out, I guess.
You're talking about Upper Huffman, and the state did purchase the right-of-way on Sultana Drive for mm-hmm. access.
To stop us at that U-turn before you go up to the hill to get to Glen Alps.
Right.
On that corner there.
Oh, right.
That was a long time ago. Yeah. So
I
back,
mean,
back to
certainly
public
be,
transport. There's a van that operates, isn't there?
Right. And that's a commercial use permit.
I think
but
it should be in municipality, a bus.
Okay,
you know, that's young people that all of us could use.
I okay, certainly would be willing to, explore it and.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Let me have our experts talk about that a little bit. So the van is a it's run by one of the local downtown bicycle rental shops, right?
Correct.
And it runs up. How often does it run up? And how do people find out about that?
It's Oh, boy, I wish I brought the little brochure. It's down on 4th. But he comes up throughout the summer, and a really nice thing that he does is he has a rack for bicycles on there, so a lot of people do a one-way trip. And so they take their bike up, they ride, and then they can ride back home. But he will do it as often as he gets a full bus, but he usually runs at least once a day.
So, and that's, I mean, if there were, I'm just assuming that if there was money to be made in running vans up there, you're not going to stop them, right? So if it's an economic thing that people can do, it will happen. Let's take another email. Shouldn't horse owners be required to shovel the manure off the middle of the trails that they use, says this emailer. I guess that's a classic user conflict issue. I don't know if that would be practical. I would think not. Yeah, I'm getting a nod. It's not practical. If you're going to let horses go, you're going to have manure around.
Right. There's two users groups. There's the people that have their own horses that are the public out using it, and then there are commercial users who take people out on trails. And so we would look at those different, just like we control the location of where the commercial people can operate versus where the public, what's open to them or not. But one of the things is the commercial operators are required to pick up in the trailhead areas.
I see. Helen?
Well, horses just brings to mind another issue, which is I'd like to ask Tom if you close the trail in the spring when it's soft to horses.
He's so, nodding. Okay, yeah.
We have in the past done that in particular because of that very reason during breakups when things are more vulnerable to damage, resource damage.
And bikes will do that too. Yeah. Yes. Well, we just have a tiny little bit of time left. Helen, did you have anything you wanted to wrap up or summarize what we were saying today? It was kind of a wild, all over the place conversation.
Well, I guess that it's a balancing act. But I also wanted to say that I think we need a lot of education of the public. And I don't know if Tom will have time to respond to this, but I have seen so much of this social trails inside the park. Where there are switchbacks, for example, people cut the corners. They don't understand. They're creating erosion that are going to wipe out the trails. Mm-hmm. And I just think we need signs and public education on stuff like that.
Seems like a lot of your job is human management rather than park management, Tom.
Yes.
Sure.
Or even most of it.
Well, you know, it's that's the way it is. Do I have a second to give a shout out?
5 seconds.
Okay, just thanks to all the volunteers from the AMRG Rescue to our advisory boards to the people that work on the trail. This park is what it is because of the volunteers.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us, and I second that those thanks. And thanks to my guests, Chugach Park Superintendent Tom Harrison, Helen Nienhauser, author of 55 Ways to the Wilderness. You can find out all about it at alaskapublic.org. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy will host two tree experts to discuss lessons learned from the big blow, ways to avoid the kind of tree damage Anchorage experienced during the September 4th windstorm. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can also join us at Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.